I think you have a lot more resonance and long-term success and meaning and purpose to your activity if you start with relationship.
You're listening to the Elevate Podcast, and I'm your host, Robert Glazer. Join me as I talk to world-class performers about how they build their capacity and reach greater heights in leadership, business, and life, and how you can do the same. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. Our quote for today is from Dario Fo. With comedy, I can search for the profound. My guest today is Baratunde Thurston, an Emmy-nominated host, producer, writer, and public speaker. He is the host and executive producer of the PBS television series America Outdoors, creator and host of the acclaimed podcast How to Citizen, and a founding partner of the new media startup Puck, where he does a lot of his writing. He's also the author of the New York Times best-selling comedic memoir, How to Be Black, an incredible speaker who has delivered multiple TED Talks with millions of viewers. Baratunde, welcome. It's great to have you join us on the Elevate Podcast.
It's good to get elevated with you, Robert.
All right. So you are clearly a gifted performer, so a comedian as well. I'm always interested with people with that sort of skill set, how that, if we think back to childhood, was that something you were always doing, finding ways to perform and to make people laugh?
I was always finding ways to perform. Just remembering one of my very early performances as a kid in a elementary school musical production. I don't know what we were, where the song came from, but there was some song about wearing a wig. And our teacher loved it and was like, "What's that on your hair? A wig. What's that on your hair? A wig. I say, what's that?" And so we made wigs. So that was part of the fun in the class. And we all danced around stage, like doing this headbanging wig motion. This is all a bunch of little black and brown kids in Washington, D.C. in the Mount Pleasant neighborhood rocking out to like, "What's that on your head?" And it brought me great joy to do that. So yeah, I've loved stage. I've loved being silly. I've loved making people laugh. Not so much being physically tickled myself. I felt that was a form of mild child abuse. All my mom's coworkers.
My youngest son would agree with you.
Yeah, you're so cute. You're so cute. I'm like, yeah, cute from a distance. If you start pinching my cheeks and wiggling around in my armpits, and it feels like I enjoy it to you, but inside I hate you. So yeah, that part was never too much fun. Anyway, it started young, Robert. It started young.
Our mutual friend, Adam Grant, I think in one of the books, he said the average professional comedian is like a sixth or seventh child. I think he postulated it was a way to get attention in a large family. That was not the case for you?
No, I was in a very small family. Primarily, it was me and my mother. My older sister, Belinda, 9 years ahead of me. So she was living a parallel, more advanced life in terms of when she was a teenager. I was just starting to like wake up to the world. And then she moved out of the house. So it was heavily just me and my mom, who was working a lot.
Yeah.
So I had time with my friends, time to myself, and a lot of time with mom. But I wasn't competing with a lot of other people for attention. I think I liked expressing myself. I played in youth orchestras. I did school plays. I ended up doing later in childhood talks and panels and things on stage. So yeah, it emerged very young and I just never turned it off.
And so you went to Harvard.
I did.
What did you study there?
Philosophy.
Okay.
Thinking about thinking.
Thinking about thinking. And someone in those environments, particularly maybe Harvard, a lot of serious, who's creative, comedic, otherwise, did that feel like it went against some of the grain or did that?
No, but I think when some people hear comedian, they have a very particular idea and I don't necessarily fulfill that idea.
Yeah. It's a delivery mechanism.
Yeah. And I was and remain like a pretty serious person. And even as a child, I was also very taken with like challenges of the world.
Yeah.
And I think performing gave me an escape at times, just to put my body and mind in a different space. And then occasionally it gave me an avenue, the opposite of escape, but a way to channel this stuff. So being at Harvard was a great place to explore serious things. And that was my predisposition. I wasn't a party animal. I didn't drink and drug. I was like kind of boring in that sense. I probably missed out on some fun because of that. But I was exposed to a ton of possibilities there and a lot of nerdy people and thought patterns. And I had a chance to play more with this expression thing. And I did do public speaking and I did do staged plays and productions and Shakespeare. And I got very silly. And a lot of my comedy voice found its first real home when I was at Harvard. The things I was doing before wasn't quite my voice. And there I was able to kind of merge my serious side that cared about the world with the need for a comedic and silly side. And I found that people appreciated it because there's a lot of self-importance and seriousness at Harvard.
We've got enough seriousness.
Yeah. And satire, like it was a great place to be satirical. There's a lot worth poking at an institution like that.
So what did you do when you graduated?
I got a job. I started paying off those loans. I stayed in Boston for another 8 years. So I kind of immersed myself in the Cambridge, Boston area. And the very first job I got was in business. And it was in strategy consulting, which I didn't know what that meant.
Yeah.
Most people don't.
Sounds important.
Including the people who do it. But it's got two very important words. Strategy, just already you're elevating things. And then consulting implies expertise, right? So you're like, it's like quality expertise from essentially a child. But I did this job for many years right after school. And it was focused on telecommunications, a really small firm that was taking advantage of the business opportunities created by the 1996 Telecommunications Act. Hilarious. So yeah, that was a natural segue from philosophy.
So I actually worked in strategy consulting out of college in a telecommunication practice for a firm, a similar time, I think, to you. And the first thing I had to do was learn acronyms. I'm sure if someone said POTS one day, I was like, I have no idea what POTS is.
Plain old telephone system, baby.
Yeah. So we can have a separate conversation about that, but that's really funny. But you had to know your acronyms doing that,
CDMA
right?
CDMA and TDMA.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and everyone was talking about 3G at the time, right?
Oh, man, 3G was coming. DSL was all the rage. Yeah. Fiber wasn't yet there. I mean, I graduated college in 1999.
I was 98, so this is almost similar. Very funny.
So we're twins. Okay, brother from another mother. My telco bro.
I do remember POTS. I was like, after the third meal, I was like, can someone tell me what POTS is? Like, is this some sophisticated thing?
I don't think we're talking about kitchenware.
Yeah.
This is something else. But yeah, that job was actually it was a really important chapter of my life. One, because of the acronyms and the deep education in the Microsoft Office suite. I mean, PowerPoint, Excel, a little Access when you want to get extra nerdy and pretend you know how to rock a light database. And then there's a great value and a great absurdity in that role.
Yeah.
And as a 21, 22-year-old, my very first assignment was to join this multi-consulting firm team to create a new mobile operator. So there were like three different consulting firms hired by a landline and company.
Yeah.
To launch a mobile virtual network operator.
I was just going to say MVNO. I was going to throw the MVNO thing at you. You beat me to it. Yeah.
But it was a crazy business to be in because they were trying to understand. We had to model every type of like consumer telecom service and then prove out the case for operating that at worse margins in terms of this like virtual operation on top of some wholesale infrastructure. It made me learn a big chunk of the business in like my first year on the job. And it was entrepreneurial. There was like this, but it was weird entrepreneurship because they outsourced the entrepreneurship to consultants, which is not really entrepreneurship.
Who are children, as you said.
I was the youngest on the team. There were senior people who had mastered the PowerPoint and the Excel far more than me at that point. And some of them had operated in the business, thankfully. But it was a wild learning experience. Expense accounts were absurd. All of it. And that is where, at the same time, started doing stand-up comedy. And the phase of my career where I took the comedy lane so seriously began there. And I don't think it's an accident. I think stand-up strategy consulting is super absurd. And I needed...
It's a great learning ground, though.
Burn off, you know, some of that reality into an equally absurd pursuit of stand-up comedy. Oh, SC and SC. Look at that.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? 2 years ago, I bought a dual suspension mountain bike for the first time, and it pushed me to ride trails that I had never been willing to try before. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has exceptional capability that will have you seeing the possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. The Lexus GX comes with available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, best-in-class towing capacity, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. I've seen the new Lexus GX popping up all around my town, and not only does it have the capabilities to take you to new places on and off the road, but it's a great-looking car. The new Lexus GX is ready to raise the bar for you. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hey, Elevate listeners. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify is the partner you need to keep the cash register ringing for your e-commerce business. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading platforms. I advise a lot of companies in the e-commerce space, and almost all of them have migrated to Shopify. And as a buyer, what I love about buying from Shopify-enabled sites is that they already know who I am, and I don't have to create a new account or enter all my payment info. The Shop Pay service makes it faster and easier to buy, which surely helps with conversions. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/elevate. All lowercase. Go to shopify.com/elevate now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/elevate.
Well, I heard you say where you were hustling around and trying to make it a stand-up. I heard you say, you mentioned I'm in Boston at the Ground Round. And yes, that brought back warm memories for me.
Wow.
That was an old stomping ground after softball games. I missed the Ground Round. We need Ground Rounds in the world.
Bring
today.
Back the Ground Round.
Was this the Cleveland Circle one you were at, or the
Route 1?
Oh, yeah.
The auto okay. Pile?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some things that stick. Yeah, we drove one, I think, north and ended up, it was right on the highway, basically.
Yeah.
You could look out the window and see cars whizzing by. Or look up and see the NCAA tournament, which a lot of people chose to watch instead of listening to my bad jokes.
Tough competition. So I know in the 2000s, you had the opportunity to work at The Onion in the heyday of that publication. That sounds a lot more fun than telecom acronym. What was that like working there? And then what did you learn from a serious standpoint working at The Onion?
So what was it like working there? It was incredible. It remains the best full-time job that I've ever had. And certainly the best employment by others. I do love the jobs I've created for myself as well. But in terms of clocking in and clocking out, The Onion is by far the best work environment and creative collaboration I think I've been a part of. Serious things I learned from The Onion was I learned most of the things I know about communications, marketing, and creative collaboration originate there. Know your story before you tell someone else or help someone else with theirs. Create your own mythology and backstory to draw from. Infuse your perspective and identity in every step of your operation, not just your product. Now, a lot of people think about The Onion at the time as newspaper or online or the videos or whatever the media was, but every aspect of even the internal operation can really benefit from maintaining that strong identity. And also, sounds really corny, but creating for and building for something bigger than yourself or more than yourself. I think The Onion is super collaborative in a way that I find really rare in the creative world. Everyone writes for this mythical character of The Onion in big air quotes. It is a news operation that has created a mythology that has no real public true personalities. They're all characters. So when everyone's writing for a set of characters, that allows ego to recede because the credit isn't public. And so you're not elbowing each other out for being top of the trending topic for the most likes, for the most traffic or attention.
They're not they weren't attributed.
No.
Okay.
So there's collective attribution, which allowed for a smoother process of collective creation. And that was really humbling. The other serious lesson I learned is just about brainstorming. I still marvel at the number of people who run a brainstorming session by calling a meeting and saying, hey, folks, we're going to brainstorm now. What are your ideas about X? And then just wait for people to start talking.
Adam has a lot of strong opinions on that. Yeah.
And stare awkwardly at each other. So the Onion process, they had a process around creativity, which allowed for the institution to like maximize the return on creative investment. And that is the worst way to talk about comedy that I could find. But you ask for the serious lessons from a silly place. And those are some of the biggest ones.
So you mentioned the word satire before. And I think obviously Onion, heavy on satire, Babylon Bees started taking on that role on social media a little bit, use satire very well. It seems like it's harder today, right? I was hearing someone talk about last week that one of the consequences of restricting free speech is that like one of his measures of free speech is how a society tolerates satire. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Whew, yeah. I think
it's complicated.
It is complicated. So you hear me taking a breath just to try to consider as much as I can, knowing my answer will never capture everything. But I feel like there's at least two elements to why satire is harder. One references what you just shared, right? When you have fear of expression or negative consequences for certain types of expression, then you're going to hold back and you're not going to push. And satire is all about pushing. So there's a natural constriction on that. It means the rewards for pulling it off are even better because you're like, how did you manage to do that in this environment? You know, so you kind of found a loophole or some way to say the unsayable. The other factor, I think, driving the challenge of satire is that the world that is to be satired has become satirical. And so when the part of the job of the satirist is to ratchet things up and to heighten absurdity, but when reality is already, it's pre-heightened, the raw material itself is absurd. We're going to have like two octogenarian candidates that most of the country dislikes strongly vying for the presidency. Like, where do you go from there, right? We're already starting with a premise of that's pretty absurd. And there are many other reasons and things that differentiate these candidates. I'm not making them equal at all.
Yeah.
I am saying there's an objectively absurd starting point to a lot. You know, we had an insurrection in this country and many, many people in power who were physically threatened by that insurrection are defending it. That is the naturally absurd place to be. So where do you go from there? So that is a creative challenge and also makes satire harder.
Do you think, though, some of it on the customer, and I know, you know, you talk about mindset and we'll get into that more, but particularly when you know someone's trying to make a joke, I think there are times when people are not trying to take a joke, not making a joke and they're serious, but you can choose to take a position of I'm going to be offended or I'm going to laugh. And I could probably use a laugh more than I could use assuming the worst today. Like, do you think we need to get a little less serious about some stuff? I know we need to be serious about some things.
Yeah. I think the answer is yes. And we're always in some kind of transition in society. And so there's a whole line of thinking and a whole line of alleged jokes which are lazy or bullying in some form.
Yeah.
They're not actually that creative. They're not saying anything interesting. They're just kind of picking on people. And so to tell the folks being picked on, like, you should just take a joke, you're minimizing something real. And what you said about us, like, finding offense in things, that's very true. Because of the echoes that get reinforced through algorithms and social media, which now shows up in our real life, we have an offense on demand opportunity in the current world where we can just live in a world of being bothered by things and not experiencing something beneath that bother, not choosing to experience it just at the surface level, you know? And so there's something that I have to decide when I'm listening to someone who's saying something I think is dumb or offensive. Like, how much is this going to get to me? And how much is it a threat to me? And that line is very blurry. It's not a simple, like, no one should ever be offended by the joke, nor is it everyone needs to only say non-offensive things. Like, there's something in between that's happening. And there's stuff that comics said 50 years ago that they would never say today because they're just explicitly racist and terrible. And everyone should be subject to a level of ridicule and pillory and sort of self-deprecation. Who's doing it and how it's delivered, that's where there's so much sensitivity. But there is no world where, like, a population can't find humor in its own circumstance. And the origins of Black comedy are right out of that, as one example. Like, I grew up, like, well, segregation could never be funny. Police brutality could never be funny. And yet, some of the greatest comic voices found ways to heighten the absurdity of that reality, make a comment, and make people laugh, you know, all at once. But there wasn't the level of micro hypercriticism. And we're also seeing a rise in, like, actual tangible threat, which puts everybody on edge. So it's a mess. It's really, I'm not going to pretend this is easy. It really, really
is. This is hard work for people who want to be funny. Well, I think your analogy of the temperature is already high, it only takes a degree or two to get the water boiling. And I think that's a really good way of thinking about it.
It's also, there are folks who, one of the greatest starting places for making your point is with yourself. As there were shock jocks in the 80s and 90s who were just explicitly trying to poke at people, but never giving of themselves, you can enter the space of, like, being offensive if you start with you and your own experience. You earn credibility with that. And I think a lot of what I get bothered by is people who are just like, I want to say the edgy thing.
Right.
Because I was told I can't say it. And I'm not a part of that group. I'm going to poke at those people over there. But if you have no existing relationship and no existing experience, and you're really not talking about you either, you're just talking about them, that's a pretty disconnected way of engaging with the world. And a lot of folks just don't have tolerance for it.
And that's fair.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So, yeah, storytelling is a big part of what you do and bringing your experience into it. I mean, you're an incredible speaker. You've had all these TED Talks. I know people who might be listening to this, and I'm sure the answer is both somehow, but how much of this, what is natural versus what is learned when it comes to public speaking and performance? There's obviously a talent component, but can you look at your own trajectory in terms of how you've changed and where you've changed and the pieces of it that you can elevate your game to use the phrase?
Yeah, to lean into elevation, I'm going to say, to the extent that I'm successful as a speaker, I'll give it 28% born with talent, and the balance is effort and luck and support. I think I underestimate the amount of training that I have. I'm 46 as we're talking, and I've been studying performance since at least 6. And I've had 4 decades of practice and failure and study, thousands and thousands and thousands of gigs of some kind, sitting on a panel, sitting on a stage, emceeing a fundraiser, emceeing a gala, keynoting a conference, terrible stand-up, pretty good stand-up, amazing stand-up, terrible stand-up again. Over and over and over and over. Zoom, perform it, like, so many different versions of performance. key moments of outside upgrades and elevation, I studied improv comedy formally, you know, in an intensive program in Chicago. I literally took a class on stand-up in Boston at the Boston Center for Adult Education in the very beginning of my career. I took media training. I've read books. I've watched other people who do it better than me. I've criticized myself. When I was doing stand-up seriously, I would record all of my sets.
Yeah, that's a huge...
And then after, I would listen and I would take notes on everything I said, the pacing, the timing, the inflection, the word choice, and I'd do an edit. And then the next time I was on stage, I'd try to implement those changes. And so there was this iterative process. So yeah, I don't want the takeaway to be, well, you just got to be born with it. That helps a lot. It really, really does. And there is so much I was born with, and I've also benefited from explicit effort. And then a lot of people looking out for me. You know, there's a lot of silent angels out there who've put in a word or given me an opportunity before I was ready and given me a chance to prove that I could do something I wasn't even necessarily sure I might be good at. So we need that too.
Did you ever get any unsolicited feedback that you were pissed about at the time, but then when you thought about it, it turned out to be pretty transformative for you?
Yeah. I mean, one, I've shared this before, so apologies if you've maybe even heard this, and I'll see if
I haven't. One,
but
yeah,
it was in Boston. It was during early stand-up period. I thought I was very good, and I wasn't. And the tiny audience, they didn't like me. They didn't think I was good or funny. And so the feedback I got was silence and then heckling, right? Immediate feedback, not like an email through my website after the fact. But it came with construction, right? It was a constructive feedback. I was doing the thing that I just criticized earlier. I was lobbing grenades at the world from a position of distance and sharing nothing of myself. And so a lot of these people in the audience, they didn't believe me. They didn't feel it. They had no credibility. They weren't connecting. And someone yelled out literally like, talk about yourself. Talk about your relationships or something. And I was like, oh boy. And so in that moment, I found something to tell that I'd never told before because I didn't operate that way. I was a calculating, analytical, critical comic about the world that was broken out there, nothing broken in me. And in that moment, I stumbled into a story of brokenness in me at a terrible moment in a relationship I had, which then allowed me to reflect on the terrible relationship we were having with our political leaders. And all of a sudden, it was like, oh.
It was real.
So yeah, it felt real. That's a positive story and a positive case with immediate devastation, but then also immediate like redemption. They don't all go that way. And there have been other moments of feedback. I got criticized for, this was through a website thing, and I had made a joke essentially at the expense of the people of Mexico. I made some joke about cartels or, and I kind of just threw all of Mexico under the bus to make a point about America's brokenness. And somebody called me out on it. And they're like, I see what you were trying to say here. You didn't really have to subject every Mexican to your comparison here. Like, here's what's really happening. And I acknowledged it. And I didn't like have an immediate redemptive moment. But I was just like, okay. Immediately, I was like, why are you being so sensitive to myself? But then I just sat with it and tried to do something better and differently in the future. And I did acknowledge them in like a future version of the newsletter where I had made that joke. So the two examples, one super awesome where I look great, one where I just learned a little lesson.
Your kind of unique ability or style, and a lot of what I've seen is it kind of even how you described your time at Harvard, but like entertainment that challenges people to think differently. How have you learned how to walk that line between entertaining people, making them laugh, and then challenging and educating them at the same time? Because I'm sure sometimes people aren't, can I laugh? Is it okay? Like, is it some awkward moments? But this seems like the thing that you've really like kind of hung your delivery on and style on.
I have learned to walk a line in part because my own existence and to some degree survival have depended on it well beyond the context of performance, speaking, comedy things. there is, the world can be a very threatening place, unwelcome place for a lot of us. We all face our challenges. For me, as a Black American male, you know, born in this country in the 70s and coming up when I did, there's a lot of risk. There's risk in the community I grew up with in terms of violence and exposure to that from drug dealers and gang members, but also from the police, right? There's risk of misinterpretation of my motives and my emotions by folks who would feel threatened by me and thus become a threat to me. So I've carried a tension my entire life around how do I walk a line that lets me be me and exist how I want to exist and also preserve my ability to exist. I think some of my rhetorical line walking comes from my existential line walking, just in the social tension that I've gotten so accustomed to and found a way to succeed in. I think being where I was from and going to the high school and the college that I went to required a level of dual consciousness, a level of code switching, a level of line walking. And so some of that shows up in the way I approach the world. I think another lesson, I'm trying to think if there's another real answer to your real question here. I've practiced a lot. I think stand-up helped me more than I often realize because you have immediate human feedback, even just energetically, and you can feel like, I'm out over my skis, or I'm not pushing enough.
Yeah. Right? You know,
and then the other thing that it's just an old trick of mine to the switching back and forth between like a hard, real statement and a ridiculous, silly statement, that level of, it's a pressure release. And so I really enjoy the expansion and the contraction. It's like breathing. It's this diaphragmatic thing where you're just like, okay, I'm going to start and just get you to like me and tell a whole bunch of silly stories. And then I'm going to make a real hard point about American racism. And then I'm going to be deprecating about the glasses I'm wearing. And then I'm going to talk about climate something. So allowing for both, that back and forth has felt, I enjoy it myself. I can't just live in the checkout lane, the world of not being connected to the hard reality. But I also just can't live in the hard reality. That's just, it's too hard. It's too depressing.
But you said something there, which I think is you develop a rapport, you make people laugh, and then you tell them some hard stuff, which I think they're maybe more open to and receptive, given that you've built that relationship with them. I mean, I think that's partially what makes it extremely effective.
It's something that I felt like I discovered it. We're humans and we think we're special, and each of us individually thinks we're special too, not just our species. And we're like, I had the realization of all realizations. And if I had read more books, you know, I might have learned it sooner. But starting with relationship rather than request or judgment or lesson or criticism or demand, like just everything starts with relationship. And that is true in the relationship between us, a stand-up comedian and their audience. It is true with a group of founders. It is true with the entrepreneur and their customers. Like if you don't start with the strategy, right? You don't start with the like the pitch or the sales collateral. I mean, you can, some people do, but I think you have a lot more resonance and long-term success and meaning and purpose to your activity if you start with relationship. And that also means listening and feeling and attuning to and learning and then having some iteration around that. So that when you launch your product or ship your message, it's more likely to land. And even though it's something I've learned implicitly or intuitively, it's still something I don't apply all the time, right? Because relationships take work.
Yeah.
And you're just like, okay, but I've learned from relationships so long ago, so I can still just apply that, right? But then I'm different now.
Right.
And whoever I'm engaged with may also be different, be that the country I'm talking about or the customer base I think I have or the business partner who I've known for such a long time.
Yeah.
It's worth checking back in to reestablish or maintain the quality of the relationship so that whatever flows from that is also quality.
It makes me think of, I don't know if you know Dr. Malik Muhammad. I had him on. He has worked with at-risk youth for over a decade. And one of his things was, he said the formula for change that he's learned with all of these kids is that change equals connection plus challenge. And he said, sometimes we, and it can go different ways, right? Sometimes we need the connection in order to challenge. And sometimes we need to challenge in order to develop the connection. And so he said it goes in different directions. But I always thought that was kind of a beautiful framework.
It is connection plus challenge. And yeah, they are in a spiral dance together.
So one of your major projects, you have a lot of them, we'll talk about that, is How to Citizen, a podcast which turns citizen into a verb. What does citizening as an action mean to you?
It means we have a lot more power and possibility than we tend to give ourselves credit for. When we see citizen merely as a birthright or a piece of paper, and we're living in a time of great division, great tumult, great fear, rightly so in many cases, but also great opportunity. You know, democracy is dying, it's in crisis, and it's being reborn and renewed. And part of that rebirth and part of that renewal is people reconnecting, right? Creating relationships to cooperatively determine our future, to collectively decide what we want and how we're going to achieve it. So citizen as a verb, in the context of this podcast that my wife Elizabeth and I have created, and what we're doing beyond just that medium, has four key principles that give more options to participation, to civic engagement, to democracy than just voting. One, show up and participate. Right, just assume there's something you can do, which is not the orientation that a lot of us are raised with.
And that doesn't mean on Twitter. That means in real life.
It can mean, but it helps. It's preferable to have. Well,
that's kind of a fire and duck mentality a lot of times. Yeah.
So show up, right? Participate, do something. Understand power. To citizen is to understand power, the many ways that we can generate and experience it. That it's not a zero sum thing, you know, because someone else has power, we can't have it. That is a false idea. One of our first guests, Eric Liu, really lays this out beautifully. And he wrote a book called You're More Powerful Than You Think. Commit to the collective. That's a hard one for us Americans. Sometimes we're like, collective, that sounds like the other C word. That's communism. What are we talking about here? What is this collectivists? Chill out.
Yeah. Beyond yourself.
Beyond yourself. There's another one of our guests who we're collaborating with more now, John Alexander, wrote a great book called Citizens, why the answer to everything is all of us. I think that's the subtitle. But take on a challenge so big, you can't achieve it by yourself. What is a business but that, right? If you could just do it by yourself, why would you hire people? You know, why would you partner with anybody? So there are strong examples of committing to collectives all around us, but our general narrative shies away from that and heightens the individual to the detriment often of individuals and the collective. And the last is to invest in relationships. That's what we've been talking about here, with yourself, with others, and with the planet around you. And to find that connection, as Malik said, and nurture it, from that springs so many things. So when you combine these, you end up with a lot more that you can do to face the challenges and the opportunities that are around us. Housing, criminal justice, food. There's beautiful things happening with groups of people who are showing up this way, many of whom are not formally citizens, but they are citizening. And the deepest premise of the work is that we are the stories that we hear about ourselves. And so we need to tell ourselves more of these stories of us actually practicing democracy. As John says, it's something you do, not just something you have. Democracy is a practice, not a possession. And so when it's challenged, one way to save it, quote unquote, is to practice it more, not just talk about the challenge of it. Be it, do it. And that's citizening to us.
There were two things you said in the last principles. It just struck me. And I think about some of what's happened since COVID is that you have a lot of people saying, I kind of want to work where I want, how I want, do my thing, right? We seem to have lost that being part of any team or any collective is not self-optimization. It has some sacrifice if you've ever been part of any organization. And then the second part is, I don't want to come to the office. And I say this as a company that's been mostly remote, but I'm saying, and then the data shows that people are super lonely, disconnected. Like, it seems like people aren't paying attention to what they're asking for. And then the reality of some of the things, like, do you think this is a problem in terms of we've seen a lot of kind of individualism and then also just people not together and forgetting what it means like to, when I've heard anyone kind of how you describe the Onion or describe the highlight of their life or career, it's rarely a solo thing. It is the best team or group that they've worked with. And I think maybe a lot of people just, they want in free agent nation kind of approach is going to miss a lot of that.
Yes. Hyper individualism will kill us all. And that is true on so many levels. There's this fractal principle that, you know, patterns repeat at every scale that we've talked about with two of our recent guests on How to Citizen, Adrienne Marie Brown and Dr. Sam Rader, folks want to reference particular episodes. But in the hyper individualism in a single human body is loneliness, depression, is overconsumption, is death by consumption, right? It's lethargy to, in many cases, becomes hyper addictive things. And sometimes, I'm not a professional psychologist, so I want to be careful of some of my language, but it is unhealthy to just be alone and try to do everything by yourself. But as a society, hyper individualism is one of the drivers of the climate crisis, right? Not taking into account our relationships with our planet, with our resources, but also our neighbors that are trees, right? They're not just our resources. And we need them. And this wildlife kind of needs us too, to help manage things in a healthy way and keep things in a balance. So yeah, we need to recognize that we need each other from a mental health, physical health, collective health perspective. And the drive to optimization of the solo self threatens all selves. And so your specific example of like remote work and work from home and me, myself, optimizing my... That is a symptom of a larger disease. It is a particular story and like a meta narrative of, well, just get yours. And the healthy response doesn't have to mean the opposite. It doesn't have to mean, well, everybody commute right 2 hours and sit in traffic and guzzle gas and be in weird, overly cooled or undercooled office environments. Like all of that doesn't have to be the answer. But we need an answer, which puts us in to company with others again in a regular basis. And that might be more dinner parties. And that might mean singing groups. Priya Parker, The Art of Gathering, we had her on our show. And just like, we need practice at being around each other. And the technologies we have have also, in many ways, encouraged the isolation further because they have us thinking we can get even more of our needs met sitting alone, you know, tapping on a screen and not being in community, you know, with other life, human life and beyond. That wasn't a reference to aliens. I was just talking about animals, by the way. Yeah.
There's a lot of data, right, around there are a certain amount of chemicals and neurotransmitters and a lot of things that when we are with each other socially are released that there's no corollary in online communication.
Yeah. If we're not going to be in the office, we need to be in our neighborhoods more. We need to be in coffee shops. We need to be in volunteer groups. We need to be in hiking clubs. We need to be in sewing circles and knitting groups and book club of something. We need to fulfill that need in a real way. So we have a great opportunity, Robert, you know, to rediscover that and apply that.
Yeah. To me, that was right. We had been a remote organization for a long time, but I always felt like that was the trade-off. Hey, we're not traveling to work. So it's almost like we expected you to be going to spin class or doing something or using that, right, in a different way to develop your community, not to not have it at all. Because I think that's a lot of people are suffering from that.
And work, as with school, they are built in communities, right? You have to show, they're kind of compulsory communities, right?
Yeah.
Where you don't necessarily like all the people, you wouldn't choose to hang out with them, but you have to. And that is a muscle that
I couldn't agree more than 1,000%. You got to coexist with some people. They got to say some things you don't like and or maybe that actually are mildly offensive.
Yeah.
And cope.
Right. And to have a relationship enough with someone for both ends of this.
Yeah.
For the person saying the offensive thing to recognize that offense lands in the body of a person who you care about, right? Not an anonymous username. It is so much easier to pop off when you have no relationship with the targets of your popping. Similarly, for the recipient of the offensive expression or language, to recognize that the person doing it maybe just didn't know any better and didn't mean the worst thing that you think they could mean by what they did. And because there's a relationship, you both have an opportunity to learn and to contribute to the other and to send and receive better the next time around. And maybe that offense will flow in a different direction and you'll have earned some credibility for how you handled the previous moment and so forth and so on. Or with the new person who joins that community, you'll remember how you were treated well the last time you offended and work to extend that grace to the new offender. Right? But all of that becomes much harder when we're isolated from each other.
And realize there's a person you could like that said something you didn't like. And then they said something you really liked the next day. And it's all in the same package.
Yeah, that sounds great. That's a great possible future. I like this.
Well, another thing I wanted to ask you about, because I heard you say something about it, it really stuck with me. And you're so good at these and answers, right? But there's a certain orientation in the world that really wants us to embrace the victim mindset and sort of how we are disadvantaged. And there are certainly a whole bunch of truths to that. But I heard you tell a story about saying that you were really frustrated one time when someone defined you by sort of the adversity that you had to overcome and that you just didn't embrace negativity. I have not seen a lot of positive worldview come out of victimization. At the same time, there is real history and hurt and things that have gone on. How do you think about this in terms of balancing optimism and self-determination with realities that have happened?
That's good. That's good. Acknowledging harm is key to healing it. And I have participated in systems of harm just by the nature of where I live, you know, where my tax dollars go, to be the most distant about it. I have hurt people's feelings before. I have said things that have hurt folks. I've made choices. And I have been hurt by the same in the other direction. The key is to both acknowledge and to process and to have a way to move through that harm that doesn't ignore it, because ignoring the harm is really risky for the harmed and the participant in the act. You don't learn your lesson. You may end up having a wound that festers and gets infected and causes greater pain later. You may end up inflicting the same harm on others as just a psychological reaction. Hurt people if they don't find a way to process their own hurt. So it's in everyone's best interest, actually, to acknowledge it and then to be provided with tools and community enough to not stop there. So how do you do that? It's very hard. It's very hard. You don't do it alone. I think that's a consistent theme we're coming back to. I don't think you can just think your way out of it by yourself and just like read a bunch of texts and solve it. I think you have to move through it. It's probably helped with others going through it with you. And it takes a bit of a leap of faith and a little delusion to live in the kind of post-harm world, in the post-victim state, in the world of agency and fulfillment and joy and power and recognition, even if the harm is continuing, right? So that I'm speaking in kind of a structure right now. Let me speak in a specific. If you're trapped in a harmful relationship, it may be a huge step just to say, like, I'm in a harmful relationship. Whew. You may not be in a position to end it or exit it, but there are obvious steps that institutions, people, medical professionals, friends, family have to help people move out of that and into something else. Part of getting out is also imagining yourself in a healthy relationship and experiencing the joy of that before you even have it in real life. That could be an interpersonal relationship in a household, parent, child, spousal. It could be a societal relationship. Womanness to patriarchy, right? Disabled community to abled community, Black American to America. And there's so much subtlety in it because there's so many different participants in the system. If someone is acknowledging harm, that is a big step for them. It is not necessarily an attack
right.
on everyone in the system where that harm is taking place. So there's just, even how we receive someone's statement of, I'm a victim, I'm not saying you're attacking me. I'm just saying like, hey, I feel like I'm victimized. Yeah. And for those who are feeling into that negative and harmful experience, it is really important to have something to anchor to beyond that. Something that you can nurture yourself in community with others that helps you psychologically and probably tangibly get to that better place of not just getting stuck in the harm. And the last dynamic I want to name here is like, I just want to destroy all these binaries as much as possible, which is something I'm also still learning to do. I grew up in classic, like male, female. Now we're learning, oh, there's a spectrum in between and like gay, straight. And there's a spectrum in between. The spectrum's of everything, it turns out. But even we've set up some roles in our rhetoric in society where like some people, quote unquote, get to be victims. And others, by inference, are victimizers. And so in this discussion that's exploded around DEI right now, you've got a lot of hurt, you know, and a lot of fear and a lot of annoyance at like, well, okay, if I run this institution and I'm not in a victim class and I must be the victimizer, and that sounds like bullshit, reverse racist nonsense to me. So screw it all. Part of the premise is flawed. We've set up a lot of the DEI discussion about rescuing people from adverse circumstances by oppressors who've put them there. And it denies the humanity, I think, of so many involved, because the benefit doesn't just accrue to the alleged victim. There is an upside to having people feel like they belong in an institution or organization that goes beyond just those targeted, underrepresented groups. It accrues to the literal bottom line, right? But we need to have the relationship that you and I have been talking about first, so that these exercises and these workshops and these initiatives and these bold statements land in the body in a way that feels connected to other bodies, not just like vague pronouncements. Because otherwise we're disconnected, disembodied from it, and we don't care.
Yeah.
We don't care.
And I heard someone say, who is a huge advocate in this, where I say, look, when you put any psychologist or sociologist, when you put people in a threatening state, you are going to have a very hard time teaching them something or getting them to learn. The opposite of what you were saying and how you do it, just build that relationship. Let's laugh. And now I'm going to kind of land a tough message with you. Like, we're humans have some immutable characteristics around threat detection. And it's very hard when you're doing that. So I think there's some social science principles, right?
Yeah.
That would be helpful to bring into that.
And the story that goes along with it, it's about this transition from me to we, right? It's about this transition from I and you to we. And I think we have thought backwards sometimes. And we're like, okay, well, the we will emerge after we hyper-define I and you.
That's super interesting, yeah.
So there may be something, I'm really kind of BSing a little bit here.
No, that's really interesting, yeah.
Like when I think about the initiatives that I've been a part of, or the workshops and exercises, and they're starting not with establishing the we. And then when I listen to the people who work in civil war zones and conflict zones and Israelis and Arabs and Hutus and Tutsis and Irish and Catholics and Protestants, they don't start with the thing, right? They start with shared stories.
I was just going to say, storytelling has always impacted me.
We both have this relationship with our parents or with our children or with our spouses. We laugh together. We cry together. And now we can talk about ceasefires. Now we can talk about our hiring methodology. Now we can talk about promotions. But we have established that we are a part of the same organism. We are a part of the same body. And we have shared fate and the shared outcome to benefit us, I'm not doing this to benefit me or to attack you. I'm doing this to benefit us. But we have to establish the us, or else we will continue to operate hyper-individualistically and destroy us. No one wants that.
I think that puts the cherry on the sundae. So I'm not going to try to top that. I know we're running out of time. So Baratunde, thanks for joining today. You've been on my interview wish list for a while, and you did not disappoint. So I'm glad we had a chance to make it happen.
Me too, man. You got me all fired up to start my West Coast day. Thank you.
We'll have you back for part two.
I'd love it. Yeah, there's so much more to discuss.
I got through about half my questions, so we'll talk about that.
So this was part one. You should even call it that. That'll put the hook.
Part one. All right. So thank you for tuning into part one today. You heard the commitment. Baratunde will be back for part two. So to our listeners, thank you for tuning into the Elevate podcast today. We'll include links to Baratunde and all his work on the detailed episode page at robertglaser.com. Thanks again for your support. Until next time, keep elevating.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.